Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and co-parents of all ages, this podcast is for you. Introducing in the center ring, the amicable divorce expert, Judith Weigel.
When I was with the circus, I was surrounded by glamorous showgirls. In fact, the year that I got married to the band leader, Clark Weigel, I wanted to live on the show, and as my punishment, they decided to try and make me a showgirl, knowing full well I had no showgirl chops whatsoever. So I became the dancing bear, and I tried to make that as glamorous and fun as I could possibly make it. But today, we have a little surprise for you. Not only do we have Pamela Payton, who is one of my favorite therapists, and I'll tell you how we met in a second, but she was also a showgirl, and she has maintained her glamour. So she's going to just give us a little bit of reference when she was that wonderful, wonderful career that I could never have. And then we're going to talk a lot about her therapy. Pamela, welcome to the show.
Hi, Judith. It's really an honor that you've invited me.
Ah, please. It's an honor that you're here. Okay, before we get into the fabulous work you do as a marriage and family therapist, can you just tell us about the show Girl for a second?
For 1 second, I don't know. It was about from the age of 18 until 30 in Las Vegas. I grew up in Las Vegas. I originally moved from Utah when I was 5 years old, so I was a devout Mormon and in a Mormon community. And it's kind of alarming that I would then become a showgirl.
Yes. So, but you did. Were you ostracized by your family?
I felt myself a little uncomfortable sometimes that if they would come and see me in the show, that there I was, because like for instance, in the opening number, there could be four parts. I'll come out with a tuxedo and the cane and dance, and then I'm ripping it off backstage and I'm coming from a flying staircase down with the feathers on and the sequins, and then I'm opening it up and there's the topless aspect of me going out there, and I wonder, what is mom and dad thinking now? You know, it's but they loved it. And it was just such a beautiful glorification, you know, those big production shows of the body. It was not done in bad taste.
I'm just so amazed because, well, first of all, entertainment is my background. I just went into family law about 10 years ago. I love everything entertainment, and I love Las Vegas more than you can know. Where did you work? What places in Las Vegas?
Well, my first show was Viva Lake Girls in the Dunes, where the Bellagio is now. And then it was a small lounge, and Paul Anka loved the show. He used to come see it all the time. It had Ron Lewis choreography, and Ron Lewis just passed away last month. Very highly acclaimed choreography, almost on the line of Bob Fosse. And so then I wanted to get into the big showroom, and that was Casino de Paris. And that's where they had the flying staircase, which was very scary and dangerous. And almost each one of us have fallen down that staircase. Oh, wow. That's a story in itself. There's many, many stories, of course. I'm putting together my showgirl book right now.
Are you really?
Yeah, then I went on to the Lido de Paris at the Stardust, and then the Hallelujah Hollywood at the MGM, which is now Bally's, and then back to the Lido, and back to the Casino de Paris, then back to the Lido. So for 12 years, I did that, and it was a wonderful experience. Matter of fact, many of us, when we've left show business, we dream about it. We sometimes dream that we miss being on stage. You know, you were in entertainment.
Absolutely. There's nothing like it, really and truly. And even though I like what I'm doing now, I do think back to those days with so many different shows I worked with. And it was just really exciting to entertain people and make relationships, you know, within
the industry. Well, tell me about that. Tell me about your show business.
Well, I started out with the Clyde Beatty Cole Brothers Circus. Then I went on to work with Artis Krainic at the Chicago Lyric Opera, the Sarasota Opera. And I never watched opera before this. I just fell into these positions with these two opera companies. Then I came to Los Angeles and started working with my brother producing live entertainment for private events. And that those are very big money makers, especially in a city like Los Angeles. Opened up my own company to specialize in ethnic entertainment because I love cultures. I just love different cultures of people and music and art. And then, you know, life just has a way of moving you in directions that you never saw for yourself. And somehow mediation, followed by family law, just came up. And I think this satisfies my desire and my need to comfort people, to make people feel good. And it's hard, and you know how hard it is, because you too, like I, you walk on emotional landmines on a daily basis. That became my new act. You never know when people are in serious pain, especially when you're working with both people. And this kind of is a great segue into what I'm going to ask you about your practice. But when you're working with both people, as opposed to just one person, it's a delicate balance how you deal with these, because what they present to you is not all of who they are, right?
Well, you know, sometimes I'll say to the one person who's across from me, you know, I've been listening to you talk about the significant other. If they were here, what would they say? Because I know I'm only getting half the story. And I'd say, if you even can you get the other person in for a session or two? And when they did, invariably, I would hear the other side of the story. And I'd look at the first person like, you can jump in any time to deny any of this. And they didn't. If anything, they looked very sheepish, like, uh-oh, you know, the cat's out of the bag. And so I realized, in order to do really more viable couples therapy or any family work when there's these significant others, you really, it's best to have everyone present so they can all tell on each other.
That's a great way of saying it.
So whenever, you know, I only have one person in the session, I do let them know I'm only hearing your point of view and only going on your point of view without the other frame of reference. I can only work with that. And I do know from people I've known personally, as well as being a therapist, that people not, well, you know, there's all the defense mechanisms of denial, rationalization, distortion, projection, and you're not necessarily going to be hearing from the person what is their problem and where they're affixing the blame, that maybe that is really a true story.
You know, yes, I can. I think anybody listening can truly relate to what you just said. And it was never so present as something that happened last year with two people who came in to file with me. We didn't mediate, we just filed. And husband comes in first and he tells his story about certain specific events. Great. Wife comes in second to do her part of the filing. And she brings up the exact same series of events, but the framework that they put around it and the intention that they infused in this or these series of events, completely and utterly different. Oh. Same event. Nobody denied the event didn't happen. Completely different frameworks and intentions around it. And I said, boy, there's a lesson in here, Judy. You know, for me as a professional, there's a lesson in here. And that is, be very careful how you process information. Absolutely, you cannot judge whatsoever, because first of all, it's not your life. You have no judgment. But if they're going to rely on you to react, it's not possible to react to one person.
Well, in your situation, you've got a different kind of a handle in how you're approaching the mediation of things. So you've got to have that mediator hat on all the time. I'm, as a therapist, and not all therapists, we work very differently from each other quite often. I'm not this Rogerian approach that I'm just sitting there and nodding my head and how do you feel about that? I think a therapist does a disservice to their client if they're not a little bit making an effort to get to the truth and being a little bit confrontive and directive. Because And I'm a brief therapist. I do a lot of assessing. I get that whole family history and what are the core issues, and I want them to talk it all out. But then it's kind of like I'll start noticing where they're stepping on their own cord and tripping themselves up, and I'll shed some light on those blind spots. And lo and behold, boom, 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 here it starts to come, and we can start to really peel away those layers and get to it. Sometimes the client will flee. They just can't go there. And let me find a therapist that, that won't do that to me.
Okay. So you just said a lot, and I'm so very happy that you said what you said. So what I didn't realize, and I don't think most people realize before they get to know therapists or attempt to hire a therapist, that not all therapists work in the same way. And what you said, I always thought, well, I didn't ever understand. Let me say it this way. I never understood when we see these scenes in movies and TV shows of therapists working that they're just nodding their heads. And I always say, well, how do you get anywhere? Don't we go to a therapist for answers, for problem solving? You know more than we do about our, hopefully, about how to unravel our lives. So what I learned when I met you at Los Angeles Marriage and Family Therapist, what I learned from going there is there are different ways that therapists practice. And how would you define your way of practicing?
Well, I bring a lot of life experiences in, so it's been really kind of great that maybe I might have a gay couple or people that have some gender identity issues and struggling on that pathway. And I danced in the show, so I knew a lot of different gay people of different aspects of being gay. I'm just like you and really gravitating to other cultures and ethnicities. My husband came from another culture, and my boyfriends all had accents. My mother wondered if I ever liked American guys. I formed a mom's group, and many of them came from other cultures and ethnicities. I have never really met any one of my friends or family members that immerses themselves in another culture as much as I have a tendency to do. And so that many of my clients are maybe 60% African American, Hispanic, Asian, because of where my office is located and that. So I find that I'm working culturally, then I'm a cognitive behavioral therapist, I'm a solution-focused therapist, and I give tools. Two main tools. I have a whole filing cabinet loaded, but my coping skills tool and my relationship toolkit, because most people struggle with how to cope with stress and life's problems and how to have healthy relationships. Two tools of just 11 pages total that are so succinct, and then I usually take about 30 minutes of a session to educate them on that. And I say, now you can choose to use them or not. You know, because what can you do? You can lead a horse to water, you can't make him drink.
That's right. Solution focused. Mm-hmm. That's what you just said. Solution focused. And I think people need to hear this because that is a style, right? That's an approach. That's a style.
Well, I want to gather everything, so I love a complete history. So usually after the first session, the intake and the assessment, they're amazed after 1 hour how much I know about them. And I say, look, I have all the key figures in your life. You know, you've gone into your family of origin. I do a genogram, the current history, and all the core issues. And now they can just really talk, get it out, and I'm taking note. And then I start to slowly but surely move the layers and sift. And like I said, some clients will run away because they maybe even had therapists before that just go along with them. And I will start to say, well, tell me a little bit more about this or that, or didn't you say before this? And they start to, some people just aren't ready, and there has to be a readiness.
Oh, that's important. So, when people come to you, if they're not really ready when it gets serious and honest and self-aware, do you think they come just to get their feet wet, or they think they can handle it, but when it gets raw and serious, they're just not ready? What happens?
There has to be... The biggest job, I think, for a therapist is if the client doesn't have the slightest bit of insight as to their contributing to their problems, then it's really difficult for the therapist to try to get them to see that. And they'll fight that, and they'll, well, all their defenses will come, you know, to the forefront, and they will run away. And sometimes I can see that a person is very highly defended, you know, especially with the borderline, and you just, that's why it's such a challenge to work with a borderline or even the anyone on the that is some aspects of narcissism, that they just don't want to own their own stuff.
Are they able to own their own stuff?
I couldn't stay a therapist as long as I have, which is now over 40 years, if I didn't believe that people could change. I know myself that I've made a number of changes in my life through my different life experiences, because after being a showgirl, on the stage, I got a degree in hotel management, and I ended up working in the hotel business, traveling. I ran Nevada's largest advertising agency. I was a social worker here in LA for 15 years. And so you take from these different experiences in life that can be very challenging, and you have to realize you make adjustments into your own nature and character in evolving on the road of life. And of course, I'm in my 70s now, and I wish I would have known some of the things that I know now back then. You know, we have to make these mistakes, right?
Right.
And so,
Pamela, if you don't mind, I was I went on your website because I, even though I know you because we belong to the same organization, and I've had the benefit of talking to you at these meetings, I still really wanted to read a little bit about your background. So when I read about you, I found some very interesting things. And here's one of the things that I found. You in the marriage and family counseling profession, you treat mental and emotional disorders within the context of marriage and family therapy. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I don't know where you're seeing that. I am a licensed marriage and family therapist, but sometimes people, by having that title, and many of us in the profession, we'd like to change that because we have training in being a therapist. Matter of fact, I didn't realize that social workers could be therapists because, after all, I could have chosen to be a social worker, but I worked as one for 15 years, but I studied to be a therapist. And I have the designation of marriage and family because we're looking at a lot more at the family structure, the family of origin, and family dynamics. And, you know, you look at different theories like Bowen theory and understanding those dynamics and how the family of origin really instructs as to who we are. That early history can't be discounted. But yet, if somebody comes to see me that, no, it's not that I only work with families. Of course, I work with individuals regarding grief, stress, loss, anxiety, depression, trauma.
So, for me, just for clarity, there are the high conflict personality disorders, sociopath, narcissism, borderline, bipolar. Did I miss anyone?
Of course, there's a whole DSM-5 that is about 3 inches thick that's loaded with them.
But aren't those the top four that get thrown around in conversation? And those are the ones that seem to come up.
ADD, ADHD, oh OCD. Gosh. Yeah.
God, who can forget about those? I mean, I'm laughing, but these are no laughing matter issues with people. These are life-changing issues. So you address these. So when people present themselves to you and you kind of look at, all right, this is probably what I'm dealing with. You don't prescribe medicine, though. That's from a psychiatrist, right?
Yes.
When you say treat, you mean through conversation, through verbal treatment, right?
Well, like, for instance, you know, therapy is a process, and you can study various processes. I mean, we go from Sigmund Freud's psychoanalysis and coming up today, insurance companies are primarily paying for this, and they want to know, does therapy work? And if so, what's the most efficacious therapy? Mm-hmm. And their research is really pointed more towards a cognitive behavioral and REBT, rational emotive behavioral therapies, as being best in resolving SMIs, severe mental, or disorders.
Okay.
And so that every diagnosis, the severe, like major depressive disorder, bipolar, schizophrenia, or anything severe like OCD, ADHD, anything severe, because any diagnosis is on a continuum of mild, moderate to severe. It's not just that diagnosis. It has, a constellation of varying degrees. And they have found that when people are initially gravely disabled with an SMI, then usually they need to be on medication and stabilized. And once they're stabilized, they give them the tools. So the medication alone is not as effective. The medication with the tools is very effective. Okay. Now, when people are high functioning and they don't have those severe mental disorders, then usually the tools alone are very effective.
So, do you work in tandem with a psychiatrist if medication is necessary?
Yes. Sometimes treatment facilities will call me and they're discharging a patient. They see that I'm on their insurance plan. And so I will work in conjunction with that discharge planner and also with getting the paperwork from their prior treatment and stepping down to outpatient treatment because I'm an outpatient therapist. I will work with the psychiatrist and they sign a release so we can confer with one another for continuity of care.
Okay, so let's go to the divorcing couple.
Oh yeah,
and let's say you're working with both of them, and maybe it was to keep the relationship together, but with enough time and exploration, they have come to the realization that they can't. What is that like when people go to couples therapy to see if their relationship can continue to have value and they should stay together? And then there's a realization with one or both that nope, we can't.
So many stories to tell on that front, because I really love working with couples. Some therapists, they hate it. They shy away from it. They're scared of it. Because it's true, you get two people in a room and things are going to escalate and you have to sit back and watch that for a while and observe the interaction and not let it get out of hand. So I'm really one to explain to the couple way in advance how I work. I am not going to be imposing my agenda on them. I'm a facilitator. I'm gathering information and I'm giving them a forum that they can come and share their stories and feel heard and understood and supported. And I will coach and navigate the fact of how they can now reflect back what the other one has said. So a little bit of teaching on how to know how to have conversations about the issues. And then the tools that I give them, the relationship toolkit goes into that more extensively. The coping skills tool I give them, this 5 steps helps them not learn how to modulate their feelings better. So I will use those tools also in the therapy and set the stage for it, as well as help them sift through the issues. And when they couldn't seem to get a meeting of the minds, then sometimes we have that aha breakthrough. I had a couple come in and she was younger than him. He's a director, and he'd be gone at long stretches. And she already had 2 children from a prior marriage and 1 child with him. And she said, I just want him to know it's over. Right from the get-go, she said that. And I'm here to just support him that he can get it, and we're going to divorce. Well, we got 3 months into the sessions because normally I don't go that long. Things are usually resolved by about 6 sessions, but we were getting now longer and deeper And we got into an issue that came up years ago. And she was from another country and she didn't fully explain to him what was bothering her. Instead, she fled and went to Europe and stayed away from him for a while and made a decision about him and came back. I think because she knew I can't really make it alone without his money. So I'm going to still live with him, even though I think that he's an awful guy because I, you know, he said or did such and such to me. And it came out in the session that she had made that decision. And he turned to her immediately shocked. And he said, but that didn't happen. This is what happened. And then he tells her the story. And now all of a sudden, there's this new revelation of what really happened that's out in the clear. And she, her eyes are big, her mouth is dropped open. And they had this understanding that she had really run it by him. She would, had falsely made this assumption. And she'd withheld intimacy, and it affected their love. And once they came to this, we worked through it. Then they said, we're really happy, Miss Payton, that you've helped us, and we hope we never see you again.
Don't you love hearing that?
It's a rarity, but it that was one occasion. A wonderful
so
occasion.
Fascinating, and it's so typical at the same time.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Communication is key. They say that people divorce because of money. Well, maybe that's an underlying. But I usually am the first one to bring up money. Isn't that amazing that I am the always? There's never that they bring it up. I will, and quite often I'm the first one to bring up sex, and I let them know I'm very broad minded. We could talk about anything and everything, but when I bring up money, 9 times out of 10, they have the slightest idea how much money they make, how to budget it, and they really don't want to know. And I'll say, well, you know, you're legally married. You need to know these things. And so I help them in understanding how they can have the meetings once a week and then to once a month and keeping on top of the budget and how to do all those different things.
You're right. I mean, we are given the statistics that money is the number one reason why people get divorced, because you need money to live, and then sex or infidelity or the withholding of intimacy comes second. But it is funny, Pamela, that when I'm filing for people, and part of the filing are these financial statements, quite often one person, and they're both, let's just say they're both highly educated, they even both may work, one person has no clue what's going on financially at all. And now you have to do these budgets and we have to run support numbers and this, that, and the other thing. And it is quite surprising that people will sign off on these joint tax returns and never even read them. And then God forbid the person totally in charge has been maybe jerry-rigging some numbers, hasn't been all that honest. Now you have this IRS issue with both of you signing off on it, and you're both involved, and now you have a bigger problem than you thought, more than just divorce. Now you have the IRS. And so I always say to people, and even on this show, trusting each other to do the right thing by each other is one thing. But being responsible for yourself, even in a relationship, is really important, especially when you're signing your name to things.
Mm-hmm. You bet.
Yeah.
Another thing that I could write on a piece of paper and hand to almost every couple that was seeing me, that I bet you're going to say this, and that is, the man is going to say, I really love my wife. I want to have sex with her, but I'm on the bottom of her list. The kids come first, the house, her job, the animals, everything. And at the end of the day, she's too tired. So then I have to turn to the woman and I'm saying, you know, if you do these different things with your man and going into detail what might be very important things to do, then you can see how it can shift things. So a man doesn't marry a woman in order for her to be celibate. You know, I have the kids and I don't need you anymore. Or just nagging him to take out the garbage all the time. And so we start to structure things that we really, you know, number one, by the time we get to 6 sessions, They have the coping skills tool, the relationship toolkit, and we get to an agreement. And the agreement helps them get more of what they're wanting and what they're stating what they don't want anymore, you know, less of that stuff. And, you know, the agreement's not a marble. They now know how they can adjust the agreement as they're going along, and they can do it without me, or they can come back in for some tweaking sessions. But for the most part, let's get it clear. Like, number one can be refer to addendum A on how you want your intimacy to go, the date nights, and you just lay it all out. And I can help you with that. Number two, look at the chore chart. Number three, let's budget our money. Number four, let's validate each other once a day. On and on. And then when you're structuring it, then you don't feel the victim of the other.
Relationships take a lot of work. I know this is a cliche, but what you just said is a lot of work. How do you speak to women? And I mean, I completely understand where women are coming from, and men too, by the way. But let's take women who maybe spend more time with the kids than dad does, maybe more in charge of the home than dad is. I mean, physically running the home. Yes, people get tired at the end of the day. So how do you deal with that, the restructuring of the priority so that intimacy is there?
Well, like I said, I think that you do a disservice to clients if you're not a little directive and confrontive, but I try to be very gently so, you know, leaning in and talking gently to them about the issues. You know, help me understand as to when you put him at the end, you know, the end of the list, what's going on. She starts to expose her anger and her disappointment. And so we have to work through all of those different feeling things and get to a greater understanding. And that's my purpose, is to help open up all those things so it can all be expressed. And then getting to their agreement, it's very much more concise and on point because we work through so many of those things. But, you know, like, I have some tapes and I'll turn around and I'll put on my TV for maybe brief instruction of the super nanny. How sometimes the super nanny pulls the parents aside and says, hey, you know, you both made these kids together. You know, you both have to be responsible for the house and the kids. And look at dad, you know, you're coming home at 9 o'clock at night and you're just not sharing, you know, doing your full share. So then it's not just me, but then the super nanny's adding something, or I've taped another brief thing on addiction. And one of the spouses has some addiction aspects. So I show a little bit on addiction. So it's not just me, but here's this docu thing that can kind of give you, or this other expert that also is saying this. And I sometimes will do that if I have the time, depending upon if they have an EAP or an insurance plan, of how I can add a little bit more to my therapy sessions.
What's an EAP?
Oh, Employee Assistance Program is what an employer would offer.
Okay. I'd never heard of that. Pamela, what happens with people once they have children and the intimacy just dissipates? What happens when they go from really digging each other and wanting to spend intimate time to not?
Well, partly I help normalize that it is normal that you're not going to have those same passionate, magnetic feelings in the beginning. So kind of educating them and predicting, so normalizing is one aspect, predicting that up ahead and spending many years together and having children and the challenges of life are going to lead to some of you, both of you, not loving each other equally, you know, even Stephen, all through the years. There'll be moments in time where you're not even sure if you want to stay in the marriage, and many different challenges to the marriage. But quite often I see that the ones who really tough it out are faith-based. They're very pulled into their faith and their history, and the alignment of those values and beliefs helps sustain the marriage considerably. I'm amazed with how many people have married their high school sweetheart and even a younger sweetheart and have been able to sustain that long marriage and never have had experienced any other people. That always blows my mind. We're seeing a greater increase of people who've been together 30 years and now realizing, do I want to spend the next 30 with this person? So a higher incidence of divorces around 30 years. One thing that really kind of, you know, ticks me off is the court system. That's why I'm glad there are mediators like you, because the court system really needs to be changed. The stories I hear, the background information of people with, if anybody's got any money at all, the lawyers just will exploit that to the nth degree. That it seems like they're constantly being pulled into court, and you think, when is this ever going to end? Well, it probably will end when they run out of money.
And it so often does. But no, you're so right. You are so very right. The court system is tough. You know, I tell people it's there if you need it. It's a building, it's filled with people, and they say things. So let's not use this as a weapon. It is what it is. It is a tool to help you come to conclusion if you need it. But let's hope you don't need it, because, and here's what I find interesting. A, when you go to trial, there's no jury. One person makes the decisions, the judge. And you're asking the judge quite often to make decisions about, let's just say, if there's emotional issues and parenting becomes the big topic. And one parent is addictive, one parent has a personality disorder, and there's real fear about the kids being alone with this parent. And even when you have experts, therapists, experts going into court to testify, you quite often have a judge who has to work in a very narrow lane of law. There are only so many options a judge can have in terms of rendering law, but even within those options, the judge has to be able to process psychological information that's being discussed, and sometimes can't process.
That's right.
Right?
Yes. Well, I guess what I've noticed is, as a brief example, I had this one producer. He had a lot of money, and he was only with this woman a year and a half and had a son. They divorced. He remarries. He's got two children. He's living in Palos Verdes Estates. And this woman, the child is now nine, and she just keeps bringing him to court. She never gets a job. She just keeps going to court. And he realizes that sometimes he doesn't even get the notice. And so he starts to realize, I better hire a private investigator. This is just getting too crazy. What's going on with her? So he was able to discover that one employer, that she did fraud. He was able to discover that some of the subpoenas that she had had an IP address, and it was a fake person, and it was really her that was supposed to be serving, and he never got served. So that there was a lot of conniving and manipulation that she was doing. And it really was boiling down to, all of a sudden now, the nine-year-old boy, she's trying to say that the father is doing harm to him and get him into Del Amo Treatment Center because now he's having psychotic episodes. And thank goodness this father had the money. After he was already $500,000 into it after all these years of litigation.
Oh my God.
And his wife is now close to divorcing him because of this crazy woman that was only with him a year and a half. And you know, finally he was able to get it out of one judge's courtroom into another judge's courtroom. And that judge said, I don't know what's going on here, but we're gonna end this. And he was willing to go through the documents, which were considerable,
I bet.
And to make sense of it all and realize, you know, that this woman, that the child was taken from the woman, he got full custody of the child. Thank goodness, save this kid from this crazy woman who was then resorting to all kinds of means to now even have her son be declared somewhat crazy in order to get back at this man, in order to continue getting money from him. It was just, wow. Just outrageous.
Wow, that's one of the horror stories you never want to hear. And yet, unfortunately, they do exist. They really do exist.
The long divorces, I don't understand it. I'm going through two clients right now that are going through long divorces. And I say, okay, and when you're in the courtroom, you know, you have to advocate for yourself. So just say briefly, Your Honor, I presented my dossier. We've gone over, you keep extending the court date. We're still not divorced. You still haven't decided child custody. What's going on here?
Yeah. I think that's a fair question. You know, Pamela, I actually think sometimes when people represent themselves, they can get farther because, I mean, there's some great attorneys out there, and I am blessed with being in a relationship with them, a referral relationship with them, and I'm happy to do it. And then there's other attorneys out there that, you're right, I mean, it's a feeding frenzy. If there's money and there's family conflict, it's a money feeding frenzy. And if you pick the wrong attorney and you don't want a feeding frenzy, that's a drag. But like follows like, or like begets like. And there will be people that have the financial resources and maybe the psychological issues to be able to find the right attorney that just loves arguing and litigating.
Mm-hmm.
And there you are in court, and you need a judge to say stop.
Yes.
Well,
now, as a matter of personal disclosure, I'd like to share with you how I did my own divorce.
And I was going to go there next, so thank you so much.
So I had a 2-year-old, and I was very hopeful that he would get a, you know, into being married. And he just was, I'm Peter Pan and I was Wendy. And I do have my Tinkerbell moments, I must say. But anyway.
You are a showgirl.
I'm home with my little honey bunny, and I'd helped him to have his pretty business, his martial arts business. And he was just gone all the time. And I said, okay, well, you know, can we make these changes? He couldn't do it. So I thought I'm going to file for divorce. And so I went to a lawyer. I sat down with my husband. We wrote down all of these things. We're in agreement. I said, try to work out an agreement with him. Shared custody, physical and legal. I'm not going to touch your businesses. Just do right by our daughter. Give me time to get a job. I'm workable. I have degrees. And, you know, it's very simple. I was wanting to be as fair as possible. I still was in love with him. I know I couldn't get what I wanted, and I just wanted to make life better for all concerned. Lawyer was writing everything up for me, and I said, as much as I could save money, let me know how. And he handed me the legal writing paper, and he said, you need to do an order to show cause, and explained it to me. And I was starting to do it. Then all of a sudden, on one meeting, he threw up his arms in the air, and he said, your husband has got trope and trope. That's the biggest dissolution law firm on the West Coast. He said, I thought you and your husband were in agreement. And I said, well, I thought we were too. I don't even know what's going on here. He says, well, you know, I don't want to deal with this now. I'm a dental lawyer.
What?
I said, oh, I didn't know you. He said, I just handled dentist offices. I just thought this is going to be a simple thing I could draw up for you. And so next thing you know, he's sending me a bill for $3,000. And all he did was pay a $150 filing fee. And I've done everything. And so I think, okay, I owe this guy $3,000. And now I got trope and trope. So I'm speaking to my husband. He says, well, I went and found out that I don't have to give you anything. And I said, but you left. You know what the bills are. I'm not asking for anything. I'm workable. What's going on here? Now you're going to have to pay this big law firm. And what are you thinking? We don't have a lot of money. We have a little baby. I couldn't reason with him. So trope and trope sent me a declaration. And I thought, well, I can do that. It looks to me like he's lying on his declaration. So I have to go on my declaration and say between this line and this line, that's not true. This is what's true. So I had to kind of defend myself as well as state my own style of life in the declaration. I did my budget, the order to show cause. I went to Santa Monica Courthouse and looked into the timely dates of filing. And what led to that is when I went to see other lawyer offices, they said, oh, $350, $500 an hour, $3,000 to $5,000 retainer fee a month. And then I got this one woman on the phone and she said, you know what? You sound smart. I think you can do this yourself. And I said, I've never been in a courtroom. People are telling me, don't do it yourself. You could lose your daughter, your property. And, you know, I had the house before I married. I helped him to have his businesses. And you don't know what you're doing. You could lose everything in there. And she just really empowered me. And I thought, okay, I'm going to see if I can. And I thought the truth should prevail. And when I submitted everything, I went to his lawyer's office and submitted my documents, got everything stamped. And we went in the courtroom, and he says, Your Honor, I'd like to continue this. And she said, well, everything's been filed in a timely manner. We're proceeding here. And it was clear to me that he was looking at everything because he hadn't bothered to read it. I guess because it's not from a lawyer. Why should he really care? And so he wanted to continue it because he was just now look. He had done a huge disservice to my ex-husband, soon to be ex. And then I didn't know what to do there. And I said, Your Honor, I have submitted my documents. And she leaned kind of forward in her chair and she said, and they have been read. And she said it just like that. And I thought, she gets me. She gets the truth. She sees it. If she read it, she sees it. And so I just kind of took a deep breath and I felt very comfortable from there. And I saw that he had to get on the stand to swear by his documents. I got on the stand to swear by my documents. And then she would ask the questions that maybe I didn't know to ask or, you know, of him and of me to get more in depth. And everything she ruled was totally in my favor. And everything was done within 45 minutes. Even though we had a child and property, and I hear so many other stories how things go on for years, she ruled that he had to help pay the bills and to give me time to get a job, which I got a job within another few months, and that there was a certain amount of child support to pay, no alimony. And then as time went by, once I got a job, I on my own lowered the child support. And I always showed him receipts for where the money was going. So I just got, I really felt, and afterwards he said, you know, my lawyer was really impressed with you. And he says, I'm really sorry for everything I've done.
This is your ex, this is your husband that said that to you.
Yeah, because he had done, you know, he was trying to create a debt situation that wasn't true. Another thing I did is I knew I had always been involved. I helped him to have those businesses, so I knew how they were run. I managed my money very well. I invest well. I had the house before I married him. I went to an accounting company, and I took our books, and I said, could you do a preliminary run of the books and do a letter that attests to what you see here? But I found an accounting company that's recognized by the courts. And this way, when he did his, the letter, the courts hold them in high esteem. And I got my ducks in a row as to the fact that, yes, there is a value in his business, contrary to what he might say. And then I went to the dean of the college to do a letter for me that my grants that I'd been working on were going to expire and that I only had so much income. So I had my ducks in a row.
So the success that you achieved in so many different ways. A, you organized yourself and you represented yourself. Amazing. Therefore, you spoke for yourself in court. Amazing. You appear to have had the right judge who really wanted to move things forward.
Mm-hmm, I did.
Okay, so that's really cool.
Jill Robinson.
I have heard that name.
Wonderful.
Okay, so that's really good. I've heard that name. And then your husband ultimately showed you respect.
Well, we have always gotten along regarding, you know, a sense of humor and the best needs of our daughter. We don't have similar parenting styles. I was the parent. He said he just wants to have fun with her. So the onus was usually on me for everything. And, you know, he's not as educated as I am. And so I just allow him a lot of leeway for the fact that sometimes he didn't know better, so he could have done better. He was then kind of manipulated by a friend to meet with this law firm, and then he just didn't use his best judgment.
Well, there are a couple very expensive law firms. I don't think that one exists anymore because the partner's deceased. One is deceased. But right before the law firm closed, they were billing at $1,000 an hour.
Well, when I heard that they were I had to arbitrate the fee he was charging me, which was ridiculous. So I went to the Bar Association and I thought, how am I going to win this? This is a lawyer. And, you know, like doctors will collude, lawyers will collude. How do I know this is going to meet with a good result for me? But I thought, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. I have to be my own best advocate. So I went in front of the bar. I showed my paperwork and I said, does this really look like a lawyer did it?
Love that.
And so I did not have to pay him anything more than the filing fee.
Wow. And this brings something else up. And this is a lesson for anybody listening. And that is, you can only go to a family law attorney. Do not go to a general practitioner. Do not go to a firm that does family law with several other things. I mean, family law is tough.
Yes.
And you have to specialize in it. I mean, if you're having an amicable divorce, it still has its process. But if it's not amicable, you really need to be with someone that knows every aspect of how to file, what to do for certain challenges within the settlement. And you can't leave that up to the family friend.
Well, it could have gone very simply, because when we sat down and I helped, I mean, heaven's sakes, this was a long time ago. My daughter was 2, she's 32 now, and I've been a therapist for like 40 years. So the length of time that I've been a therapist, that some of that time was when I was even interning. But I knew enough to sit down, let's try to do an agreement, and let's just go to a lawyer to write it up, and then we'll just get a very simple divorce. I'm not asking for a share of your businesses. I'll just keep the house, you keep the businesses, we'll share our daughter, and let's work out this visitation that she lives with me and she visits you enough that she's got 50-50. So I know that I was very fair, and I remained fair all along the way. I showed him receipts of where his money was going. I do hear horror stories of how they make it so hard on the children, because one person maybe is communicating fairly and the other one is just always doing war on the other one.
I know. That is the toughest of all when there are children. Pamela, as we're concluding, just a question, since you are a therapist and I am not, I'm a mediator. But I look at people and I just say, I'm not sure that you two should have had children. I mean, I say it to myself. I certainly don't say it to the people. But, you know, I look at all these cases and I say, just because you can doesn't mean you should. I mean, yeah. They seem to have no clue how to talk to their kids, how to work out the divorce. I mean, so many people, well, don't we have to involve our children? Don't they need to know what happened? Oh, my God. I mean, just to say that, I'm in shock that anybody would think they need to sit their kids down and go through all the details of what went wrong in the marriage.
No, that's awful. Yeah, but I've always tried to emphasize in my own coming apart, dad's house, mom's house. I want my daughter to think highly of her dad. I want her to love him. So when I'm working with my clients as well, that having an understanding that don't bring adult matters to your child. Don't destroy, you know, the view that your child has of each parent. Sometimes the child will say, well, daddy tells me very different things, or mommy tells me different things. Who's telling me the truth about this and that? They do get all these different stories hammered at them. And, you know, you can't control the other person, but the person who's in counseling with me, I'm always, you know, I give them the tools and I'm always emphasizing how they can try to explain things to their child without putting down the other person.
Yes. Yes, yes, and yes. And you're right. You can't control the other person. You can only control yourself. Mm-hmm. And putting down the other parent has, I don't know where the value is in that. There is zero value in that.
Totally.
Yeah, I feel really sorry. As takeaways, can you give our listeners any maybe two or three tools to use if they're in the middle of a divorce, just to calm things down and get everybody to forgive and focus on being the best they can be ending the marriage? Any little tips?
Well, hopefully there's been some that's been picked up from our discussion here today, because there was a lot of different pointers there. Come see me if you want to have the coping skills tool and the relationship toolkit and how to get to an agreement. Even if you're staying together or coming apart, you need those tools. They help you with all relationships, but also going down that road of how to carve out sharing our children between mom's house and dad's house. And, you know, that meet immaturity with maturity. That it doesn't mean that somebody is behaving badly, that you have to as well. Take some deep breaths and realize you don't have to catch that argument ball. Let it whiz right on by you and realize that you can be a bigger person.
Well said. I like that. You don't have to catch that argument ball. Let it go by you. Yeah. Yeah. That's great. So Pamela, how can people get in touch with you?
Well, should I give my phone number or just
whatever
go on Facebook?
Whatever you're comfortable with, whatever you're comfortable with.
Okay, so probably if you Google me, you can see me and my phone number, but I'm Pamela Payton at 310-839-1995. I take all insurance and all EAPs, and work sliding scale as well.
Okay, that's beautiful. See, that's beautiful that you take insurance and you do sliding scale. I mean, you've covered all bases. And everybody, she is right. I Googled her. She comes right up. The phone number is there. And you will see her name written in the show notes when as you look at this episode. Pamela, thank you. This was so much fun. After knowing you all these years, to sit down and have this focused conversation, because we never get to do it at our meetings. We're 5 minutes and then something else and someone else comes up.
I love this. Thank you so much, Judith. It was very fun to do it. You know, it's very much flattering that you want to include me on your show. Thank you so much.
Oh, flattering that you're even here. And flattered to all of you as well that you have joined us. I appreciate each and every one of you. There's valuable information coming through each and every episode. You can reach me through the podcast website, theamicabledivorceexpert.com. TheAmicableDivorceExpert.com. Share this with your friends and give me topic ideas. You know, I'm always open. But most importantly, as always, have an amicable day.
That's our show for today. Thank you for joining us. Be good to yourselves, be kind to your spouse, and cherish your children above all else.